You're listening to a Davenport After Dark podcast. Tune in every Thursday night at 10 o'clock on News Talk 106 to 108. This week, as most of you know, it's the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, which, despite Bush's declaring mission accomplished less than 6 weeks later, it was, I suppose you could say, it was the biggest international news story of the decade, along with the war in Afghanistan. And obviously there's been lots of retrospectives this week, looking at a whole variety of elements relating to the war and its effect on us all.
Yeah, we've seen, like, I suppose, a lot of great clips you've heard, like from Colin Powell at the UN, like in his weapons of mass destruction, to Tony Blair's case for war. He basically made a humanitarian case for war that, you know, we were doing this for the people of Iraq. And the sexed up, the now infamous sexed up dossier. And and then, like you said, the mission accomplished.
There's lots of various issues relating to the media. I mean, and particularly media that were representing the main combatants, the UK, US, and I've denoted something of a slightly sheepish tone. I mean, now, there's the whole issue of embedded journalists, because let's be honest, it's hard to report objectively on, I don't know, an atrocity against civilians if you're relying on the troops who committed it for access and security.
Yeah, but that's always going to be an issue, like with embedded journalism, but... like, there's a question of access to conflict zones. You know what I mean? And safe access to conflict zones. And how do you get there otherwise? You know what I mean? That you're gonna have to go in with one side or the other. And then once you're in there, like, I suppose human psychology comes into it a bit. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no doubt.
Like, you're with a group of men or women who are protecting you. They're protecting your life. You know what I mean? If someone opens fire in your direction, they're gonna open fire back. Like, are you meant to kind of? I know, yeah, you're meant to be impartial, but it's very hard, like, on a human level to kind of think, I'm actually going to slate these guys.
No, absolutely. And I think the rationale behind it makes an awful lot of sense. But then there is that big argument that the media not only failed, but they didn't cover themselves in any kind of glory and have had to deal with very troubling accusations, not just bias, but an actual complicity in what a lot of people consider to be criminal deception as to the whole justification for war. Now, Karen Ross, he's a former British diplomat who resigned over Britain's role in the Iraq war. And he spoke to Shona Murray on World in Motion this week. And he made the point that the media weren't aggressive enough when it came to dealing with Bush.
There was a whole culture of, you know, you're either with us or you're against us. I know of journalists who told me that they tried to write about the very dubious case for war, and they were rolled over by their editorial boards, by the owners.
OK, and forgive the quality of the line there. But we're joined on the line by Roy Greenslade, who's a media commentator and professor of journalism at the City University of London. Roy, good evening to you.
Good evening.
Now, in 2003, so not long after the war began, you wrote an article in which you said that because Rupert Murdoch had made a strong case personally for invading Iraq, it stood to reason that his 175 different news outlets would follow suit. And of course they did. But so then, do you think it was simply a case of a media mogul imposing his personal beliefs on his empire and every single journalist and editor following suit?
Well, every single editor. I don't know about the journalists. There were some divisions there, I'm sure. But there is newspapers aren't a democracy. It's quite straightforward. The owner has his way, and his editors carry out his commands. And that would be particularly true of Rupert Murdoch's organization across the world. It was extraordinary when you think about it. There was a million people marched against the war in Britain, but every single Murdoch paper was gung-ho for the war. There was a big split in Australia, and yet his papers in Australia were for it. And, of course, his American papers were too. What was unusual about the situation is that in those days, Rupert Murdoch was very discreet about his views, and so you weren't usually able to divine them.
Yeah.
But before the war, he actually announced that he was in favor of it. He was in favor of it because he believed, and this sounds absurd now, in $20 a barrel oil, which, of course, has never come to pass. He thought that that's why they should fight it. He was very open about that. And so we did know that he wanted to, and it was that which made me contact as many of those 175 papers as I could. Just one, only one of those 175 didn't come out for the war, and that's because it didn't really get involved in the war at all. That was in Papua New Guinea, and I don't know if he even knew a war was on, but it certainly didn't carry material either way. Otherwise, every single paper was pushing for war.
But even newspapers and news outlets that have a reputation either for, you know, strict neutrality or a liberal bias, like I'm thinking perhaps of the New York Times having a liberal bias, but then neutral outlets like Reuters, and their slogan is freedom from bias, their staff joked that the slogan should actually be overlaying our own prejudices.
Yes, well, I mean, let's start with the New York Times. I mean, they were they had a reporter who had a source. We now know that this was a bad source. And they were running news stories which were suggesting that they had WMD. They also suggested that Saddam Hussein was seeking material in Niger to make nuclear weapons, which again turned out to be false. But these were believed at the time, and the New York Times published this material by one reporter with one source, and the source was an Iraqi who was extremely keen to get into power himself to replace Saddam Hussein. In Reuters' case, I think it's quite clear that although we like to believe news agencies like that are entirely without any prejudice, there was a definite military spirit about the about America in the aftermath of 9/11. I went about a year after 9/11, less than a year actually, about 8 or 9 months after 9/11 to visit the Los Angeles Times for an editorial board meeting. And at that time, when I suggested during the meeting that the next thing you'll be doing is invading Iraq, they laughed at me and they said, no, that wouldn't come about. They wouldn't allow that to happen. And yet within something like 6 to 9 months, every major American paper, including the Los Angeles Times, were keen to push for war. So the persuasiveness of Bush, of Cheney, and of the organs of what I'd call news management had convinced virtually everyone that war was inevitable, that it was good, that we needed to depose this regime, and if not, they threatened the free world, as it was called. And that is infected Reuters as much as it infected the rest of American media.
So was this then really, like, this enthusiasm for war, like, how much of it was kind of a natural thing then that grew out of 9/11? Or was it, like, was that kind of the first victory for the coalition forces, really? Was there how good they were convincing the media to kind of jump on board?
Well, I think 9/11 is key to the whole thing. And, I mean, I think the misunderstanding, the grotesque misunderstandings, which were, again, part of news management about who was responsible for 9/11, played a huge part in the wish to go to war. The deep belief, which, by the way, persists in America, that Saddam Hussein was somehow linked or responsible for 9/11, took hold in such a way that it's impossible to talk people down from it. And it was helped by the fact that in the United States, unlike Britain, and I'll come on to that in a moment, but in the United States, you have this mass of commercial radio stations which are right of center, which have these shock jocks, which are nearly all right wing. You had this new powerful organ started by Rupert Murdoch, Fox News. If you add on the kind of stories that were coming through in the New York Times, which seemed to support the belief that Hussein was up to no good, then you created, I think, a sense in which, and this has happened in other wars too, so it's not too surprising, but you actually turned the American people onto the idea that war was necessary.
Because I remember there was a great cartoon in a newspaper in Ireland at the time of George Bush standing in the UN with a flip chart, and he had Iraq and Al-Qaeda written with circles around the Q in both of them and a connection between them. But like, in the UK and in the US, like, were the media kind of intentionally vague about links between them, or were they kind of intentionally ambiguous about, like, kind of the Al-Qaeda-Iraq connection or lack of connection ultimately?
Well, I don't think there was anything like the belief in Britain about Saddam Hussein being responsible. I mean, I think that we are well used in Britain. I hate to say we're more sophisticated than Americans. I think we're more sophisticated in terms of understanding that there's not something called Arabia. We understand it's split into many countries. We know that Sunni Muslims are different from Shia Muslims. We understand the differences in terms of Saudi Arabia, the Yemen, Iraq, Iran, and so on. So I think that we understood early on that the major source of the bombing of 9/11, the use of the planes, came from within Saudi Arabia, probably involved Syria. We didn't ever think that it was linked to Iraq. So the reasons that we went to war had much more to do with the persuasiveness of Tony Blair, again, though, misusing, and I have to use that advisedly, maybe even concocting, a fake dossier, again, relying really on weapons of mass destruction. He consistently denied regime change, but he's changed his tune ever since because he says, you know, we did a good thing by getting rid of Saddam Hussein. So there were these three linked things. There was, in the United States, there was definitely the belief that he was responsible for 9/11. There was the belief that he had WMDs, and a lesser belief in the need for America to go in and regime change. But in Britain, I think it came down much more to WMD fears linked to a belief, in a way. Tony Blair, I think, is probably the most missionary of prime ministers we've ever had, certainly since Churchill. And actually believed that he was a world, that he believed he could change the world order. He'd done that in Bosnia, he felt, and now he was going to do it in Iraq.
Roy, we said earlier, war and any kind of national crisis is always going to result in a certain amount of media complicity. But this particular war was compounded, do you think, by the pressures imposed on mainstream media by the appetite for 24-hour news, the never-ending cycle, and also by the advent of social media as a legitimate source of information, well, or certainly an immediate source of information. So do you think that mainstream media, with those twin pressures operating against it, felt that it had little room to manoeuvre?
Well, I think the 24-hour news cycle was more important than social media. I don't think social media had quite gripped in the way that it would today. But I do think that feeding the beast, as Alistair Campbell, director of communications for Tony Blair, used to call it, feeding the beast of a 24-hour news cycle, meant that in many ways there was a constant need every so often to have what we might call a new angle. And I'm afraid that the new angle would always be, tended to be, a warlike, a bellicose angle, rather than one which was standing people down. And I think that was problematic. But I think there were huge failings for the media in terms of really turning away from stories that were there, that had an anti-war feel. For instance, Blix, Hans Blix, who went in on behalf of the UN and came back and said, look, I don't think he has these weapons. That was played down.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, whatever anyone says about whether there's bias, at times, and I've noticed this, you know, by studying newspapers going back to the Suez confrontation in 1956 and every war since, there is, and editors wouldn't like to think this, but there is something which takes over. I saw it particularly during the Falklands War, the Falklands invasion, in which it was quite clear that although many people were either apathetic about it or not keen on it, and that would be true also of the journalists within the newsrooms, gradually there was an acceptance that it was inevitable. And then after it had taken place, patriotism, patriotism kicks in.
But Roy, and there's it's a perfect storm almost. You have a generation that has grown up now with social media, and are they then going to turn their backs on mainstream media as unreliable, unworthy of their trust because of the examples of the reporting of the Iraq war, and also coupled with the immediacy that they get from social media, they don't need mainstream media anymore. They don't need the newspapers. They can get their information direct, uncut, uncensored from, you know, some guy tweeting from Baghdad.
Well, it's hard to predict the future, but my view at the moment is that mainstream media still sets the agenda, and that we tend to we can overlook that. We can believe that things can change with social media, and certainly, say, in a rebellious situation, as we saw in Tunisia, to an extent in Egypt, it can help build among the people a feeling of defiance and of rebellion. But when you come to a much more stable society and you're fighting an exterior war as distinct from an interior one, I think that it's altogether different.
Okay.
It is, if I may say, by the way, thinking back 30 years to the conflict in the north of Ireland, it is extraordinary to think the difference that might have occurred should social media have existed.
Absolutely.
Then.
All right, listen, we're going to have to leave it there. Roy Greenslade, thank you very much for talking to us. That was a Davenport After Dark podcast, live every Thursday night at 10 p.m. on News Talk 106 to 108 FM.